Dave's Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
So, today, like I said, we're going to leave. This will be our last analysis of variance class. Two topics today, Latin squares and empty cells. Latin squares, really, these are two topics that I could almost skip. And in fact, there have been years where I went to a conference this week and we skipped these two topics. Because they're something you're probably never going to run into. But with careful design, you want to have empty cells, and Latin squares are a bit of a pain. That said, 2 years ago or last year, someone had a Latin square in their honors thesis. So it's not ridiculous to learn this. So we've discussed procedures for dealing with a nuisance variable, and that's, of course, blocking, right? You could also just use basic sort of repeated measures, which in essence is a special case of a randomized block design. In that case, the block is the person. That's a nuisance variable because it's the same person. We know there's variance there we can take out. So really, it's remember, repeated measures is a special case of blocking. Nonetheless, that's the way that you would normally deal with such a thing. You can also use it in something we won't talk about in this class, but you might see on SPSS, which is called ANCOVA, Analysis of Covariance. What it basically does, ANCOVA, is let's just say you have some variable. I don't know. Let's say you're looking at how well people do in school, and you're looking at what their major is. Clearly not a very interesting experiment, but, you know, so you're looking at different, what are averages in different subjects, okay? What you might want to do is take out people's IQ. Because maybe you want to just look at, are they getting marked easier in one subject than another? So let's just take out their actual intelligence quotient, because we know that's going to correlate quite nicely. Right? So what you do in that case, and you'll see this if you take a look at ANOVA, the ANOVA procedure, or the GLM procedure in SPSS, you can throw in what's called a covariate. And what it does is it statistically removes the variance due, in that case, to IQ. It's a little more complicated than that, but in essence, that's what it does. And ANCOVA is a perfectly reasonable thing. If you go to graduate school, you'll probably learn a little bit more about ANCOVA. But again, it's one of those things that you'll probably skip, because it's not entirely necessary. It's easy enough to understand. I know that we were taught ANCOVA in, I guess, our first stats class in the master's year, and Ian didn't even teach it that day. He had a graduate student come in because he didn't care. It's just like, it was the same as his attitude towards post-hoc tests. It's stupid. I didn't want to do it. Proper design can take care of this, you know, so. But you could do ANCOVA. Oh, by the way, speaking of SPSS, I think Amy's going to do one more about doing, like, multi-factor analysis of variance tomorrow. I'll confirm that and I'll send out an email. I'll send out an email from my new Jesus phone. I, you know why I got a new phone? Well, I needed a new phone, but my wife got a cool smartphone and I wanted a better phone than her. I'm such an idiot. Hers is cool though, a little HTC. Run on Android, it's nice. I don't know, I was talking actually to Danielle on Facebook. There's actually an app to do analysis of variance. That's awesome. Not repeated measures, though. No, I know. It's the most annoying part of it, right? What if you had two nuisance variables? And this certainly could happen, right? So, you know, when I was showing you what the randomized block design looked like, I put the blocks in rows. And then in columns, I put the variable. Fair enough, you could go the other way. So now you have two nuisance variables and a third variable. That's the independent variable you're interested in. Right? So now not only do you have blocks of one nuisance variable, you could perhaps do it with blocks of two. And what you do, though, in a Latin square is you actually kind of put them together. So you put one in the rows and the other one in columns, and for some reason that excited me so much that I put that many exclamation points. You certainly could do nuisance variable 1, nuisance variable 2, and independent variable, and set up a 3x3x4. That would be really hard to do. So this is your Latin squares are an easier way to deal with two nuisance variables at the same time. I'm just happy we're getting to the end of analysis of variance, basically. That's I love this stuff and I'm getting sick of it. So you get something that looks like this. The rows and columns, okay, those are the nuisance variables. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. And I know that we've been using A, B, C, and D for different independent variables. In the sort of notation that's used in Latin squares, they're just the levels of the independent variable. So it's not four independent variables. It's some independent variable, whatever the hell it is we're measuring, with four levels. And we're going to call them A, B, C, and D, just to distinguish them from the four levels of root nuisance variable 1 and the four levels of nuisance variable 2.
What would be an example? So if you did the university one, maybe what you would
do? Yeah. Yeah, let's go with that. So, except that's not even that good there. Because it doesn't work because I picked IQ because it's so variable. What if we had... Let's go back to our French experience learning French. So we're using four different teaching methods, and that's what we're interested in, A, B, C, and D. Method A might be rote learning. Method B might be something interactive. Method C is listening to French podcasts. I don't know. Whatever. And level D is some kind of control, I guess. That was good. I didn't have to think of anything else. These rows here could be your previous experience with French. 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, and 4 years in high school of French. And the columns... And the columns would have to be something else. What could that be? Okay. Different cities, different hometowns, things like that, conceivably. Yeah, maybe we could do something like that. We could. I mean, it's not great, but for our purposes, it'll do. So now we've got someone who's in first year. Or sorry, not first year. Well, we could even do that. Yeah. So let's make that first year, second year, third year, fourth year, and years of high school experience in French. Okay, person's in first year, has 1 year of high school French, and is getting teaching method A. The next subject here is in first year, has 1 year of high school French, is in second year university, and is getting method B. This person here has 3 years, so up to grade 11 of French, is in third year of university, and is getting method A. Okay. Yeah, that's actually not a bad example. Think about if we had to do this, we would need, if we wanted to cross everything, have all the interactions there, we would need to find four of each, four first-year university students that have four, that sorry, and that also have that are in first that, that have 1 year of high school French. So four first years with 1 year, and then we give them A, and then we do it with B, a C. Suddenly, instead of needing, here what do we have? We have 16 subjects. To do that experiment, you need 64 subjects, 4x4x4. It's going to probably be hard to find all those people. In fact, it's going to be exceedingly hard, I would imagine. Right? It's going to be very difficult. Almost as hard as it is for me to find where I put my mouse. There it is. What happens here is each level occurs in each ordinal position. In other words, A occurs first, as often as it also occurs second. It occurs third and fourth. So does B. So does C. etc. Okay? Make sense so far? You might have run into this in 2127. Let's worry about order effects right now. But did you worry about, did you learn about Latin squares in 2127?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's one way to, that, it is a way to deal with order effects, but not carryover effects. Right? If you had the same person, right? So each row and each column has each level once. Row 1 has A once. Row 2 has A once. Column 1 has B once. Column 2 has B once. 3, 4. So now instead of needing 64 people, we have to find 16 people. It's going to be quite a bit easier. And remember, if we were blocking on 1 and 1 and 1 and 2, we have to make sure that they all have 1 year of high school French and they're all in first year. That's not going to be an easy thing to set up. Right? Blocking on two variables can be done. There's nothing wrong with it. It's not illegal or anything. It's just, it's hard to do. And think about, like I said, a 4x4, so you got 64 subjects. You might be able to find 64 subjects that meet the criterion. It's certainly possible. What if you had 5 levels? Now you need 125 people. If you have 6, you need 6 times 6, 36 times 6. What is that? 72, 144, 3, 256. I think. No, that can't be right. 72 and 72, 144, 8, 258. No. This is going to piss me off until I get it right. 288. That still seems wrong somehow. If you had 10, you'd need 1,000. Instead of 10 people, you'd need 1,000. That's stupid. Who's going to collect 1,000? You're going to find 1,000 Algoma University students. Well, that's all of us, pretty much, isn't it? There's 1,200 of you guys. Or you could just do this. It's quite a bit easier, right? So you need equal numbers of rows, columns, and independent variable levels. You need all three of those to be equal. Here's the model. X equals mu plus alpha plus beta plus gamma plus epsilon. This is any score, of course, and that's the grand mean. This is, now, again, this isn't my fault. This is the way things are done. Don't get mad at me for alpha and beta meaning all kinds of different things, different times. For this, it's alpha is rows, beta is columns, and gamma is the independent variable. And of course, that's error. I could make up my own notation, but then if you ever looked at anything up in a book, you'd go, I don't know what that means. Or if you got to graduate school and they'd show you, they go, I don't know. Dave used jelly beans and oranges. So I just stick with standards. All right. So there's the model. Notice anything about that model? No interactions. Yep. Well, think about it. How can you test interactions when we don't have equal numbers of subjects? For, you know, you'd have to have, the say, 5x5x5. Right? This is bugging the hell out of me. 72 and 72 is 144. It's like 196. Okay, now I'm back. I think. We're 216? God, this is bugging me. I used to have a mind like a steel trap. Now it's just a rusty trap, you know? Okay. So the analysis of variance summary table looks like this. Rows, columns, independent variable, residual. Whoops, sorry, I should go back. I thought I had a little thing there. P minus 1 is the number of rows, columns, and independent variables. P minus 1 is the number of rows, the number of columns, and the number of independent variables. Because they have to, levels of the independent variable, because they have to be equal. P is the number of rows or columns or levels plus 1. So if you saw something like this and it said 4, 4, 4, 12, you know that has to be a Latin square with 5 levels. Because it's 4 is the number of rows minus 1. Oh, yeah, what am I saying? No, P is the number of rows, not the number of rows minus 1. Duh. Yeah, P is the number of rows or columns or levels. The independent variable. Sorry about that. I'm thinking ahead to regression. I'm progressing to regression. Yeah. What do you think of that? So, again, sorry, P is the number of rows or the number of columns or the number of levels, independent variable. So, again, if it said 4, 4, 4, 12. Right. That means it's a 5. A Latin square with 5 by 5 Latin square. Right? You look like that bothers you. Here, I'll show you. There's an easy way to show this to you. So the 5 by 5, how many observations? 25, right? Yeah, so 20. So it has how many degrees of freedom? 24 for total, right? So rows is going to have 4. Columns is going to have 4. Independent variable is going to have 4. What's left? 4 and 4 is 8 and 4 is 12. And 12. Yep. That's the easy answer. Yep. If it was 7, it would be 6, 6, 6. Ooh. Are y'all scared now? So it'd be 6 times 5, 30. Yeah, that's right. That's right. No, that's right. That's right. Exactly. 48. Yeah, because 7 times 7 is 49.
What do you mean by residual?
Error. What's left over? Yeah. Really important thing to take care of here is Danielle mentioned when we looked at the model, there are no interactions and there is no way to test them and there's no way to find out even if they even exist with this model, with this design. There's no way even through exploratory data analysis to guess. Remember, like with the randomized block design, you could look and say, those lines seem to cross. There might be an interaction here. The problem here is, if there is an interaction, there's no way you can see it. You can make a nice guess with randomized block. If those lines cross, or there's a when you go block and IV, you might say that the lines aren't very parallel, or they cross. I shouldn't use this model. With this, there's literally no way to tell. So there bloody well better not be any interactions, because all that error is all going to go into residual, which is your error term. All right. Questions about that? It's not a bad thing to set up. They're not that hard to do. These can be useful if you can meet their rather stringent assumptions. And those assumptions are what? Equal numbers of rows, columns, independent variables, and no interactions. Right? And the only way you know if you have no interactions is by hoping. Previous research might tell you, logic might tell you there's no interactions, but you don't know it about your own data. You just have to be hopeful. Now look, if it comes out significant, who gives a crap? Because it all goes into residual anyway. All you're going to do is make a false negative, not a false positive. Nonetheless, you got to be really careful about this. But it's a useful tool. And you do see them come up now and then when people have more than one nuisance variable. How do you pick your Latin square? Now, you saw what I did. A, B, C, D, D, A. That's just one of a whole number of possibilities. A really good statistics book, or alternatively, Google, will find you a way to randomly select Latin squares. right? So what you do, see, because it isn't necessarily the case that 1, 1 should have A in it. Why should 1 and 1 be A? Maybe 1 and 1 could be D. Could be. Why not? So, in that case, what you have to do actually is randomly select the square. And like I said, a really good graduate level stats book will have a Latin square table at the back. Going up to only so many. There's only so many, you know, you can't get up to the 5 and 6 ones, or six, more than 5 usually, because then you end up with literally thousands of possibilities and tens of thousands. But you can, I'm sure you could do this. There must be online tools to do it. I wouldn't be surprised if there's online tools to do everything else. There's probably an iPhone app. There probably is. If not, maybe I'll rate that one. And I'll give it away for free, because nobody'd buy it. I won't buy the 99-cent ones. I look at some, not buying it. It's pathetic, really. I can't wait to spend $15 on downloadable content for Modern Warfare 2, like as soon as it comes out on March 30th. But 99 cents? What are you, insane? I don't want something useful. So you just do that, and you randomly pick which one you want to have. Yeah, there's all, you can get really complicated here. You could have like a Latin cube, but it's not a square, it's a cube. It's not Latin anymore. It's called a Greco-Roman cube or something. Right? And what it's got rows, columns, then it's got depth. You analyze it the same way, except now you've got rows, columns, I guess they call it depth, independent variable, and residual. You could even do something that we were given in graduate school, an example on an exam. We were just given two Latin squares beside each other, but they were different, and we were told to construct the source of variation degrees of freedom table, and no one ever told us how to do that before. But you do have another source of variation there. It's called square, so you get two squares. That was kind of, some of us figured that out. We also had one with an incomplete Latin square, which was just evil, and I can't even remember how the hell I did it. It was just like A, B, C, D, and then, but didn't have 4, it was 4 by 3. I can't even remember what I did. And you can even do ones with 4, like depth. So rows, columns, depth, and then other cubes. And then you use Hebrew letters, and I'm not kidding. And it's called a hyper Latin Greco squarey thing. I'm not making that up. Nobody uses these. Are the kind of things that show up in statistics journals. And that's good reading. That's fun. That's good times. You'll never run into those, except if you go to grad school and they usually have a couple of, as Ian used to always say, you're going to get perfect on my exam, you know, I want to make sure you actually know this stuff. So I have to have a question here and here that separates the men from the boys. And he used to say that on purpose, I think, just to piss some people off because of men and boys versus, you know, I think he did that on purpose for fun because that's what he was like. I'll tell you guys, the day he found out I did an impression of him, he came in and did an impression of me. It was great. He went. I used to wear big black motorcycle boots. It was the 80s, okay, with chains hanging off of them, and I had really long hair in a ponytail. And so he comes in, I wear a black leather jacket, like a bomber jacket. So he goes off to his office. He goes and puts on a pair of rubber boots, because that's the closest thing he had. And then he goes to like a janitor closet and gets a mop and puts it on his head because it's white and long. And he comes in and he starts swearing and using the word dude a lot. It was really funny. It was great. So that's Latin squares. Any questions about them before we talk about empty cells? All right. So they're not that bad. Oops, let's go back. So, we'll talk about unequal cell sizes, first of all, because I'm always saying this is the number of subjects per cell, right? I'm not saying that it's, you know, this is the number of subjects in group 1, in group 2, and group 3. In fact, most of our designs assume equal ends, don't they? I've just said that, you know, there's an equal number of subjects per group. One way ANOVA you can get away with not having equal cell sizes. You can get away with it. By the way, the formula that most people are taught about how to analyze unequal cell sizes is wrong with ANOVA. It's a long, arduous story, but using the harmonic mean, it's incorrect. That was proved about 10 or 15 years ago. It's still in all kinds of drug stats books, though. Let's say you have unequal ends, though, except for a simple one way, which is totally doable and no big deal. What do you do? Well, you could estimate the missing values. Like, you know, let's say you have 5, 5, 5, and 2. Well, maybe you can estimate the other 3 for the cell that has only 2 people in it. You could use the mean or the media. I think the median. Or you could have the media do it, because they're always trying to screw around with us. Damn media. And their liberal agenda. Use the median or the mean. It's a thought. One could do that. If you do that, or, you know, by the way, if you do that, you don't get degrees of freedom for that, right? Like, when you do the analysis, you throw it in the computer, it's going to tell you what your degrees of freedom are, and they're wrong, because those numbers were arbitrarily assigned by you, not by the numbers themselves. So use your original degrees of freedom. Keep that in mind. Do you include interactions or not? So what do I mean there? Well, let's say that right now, if we have some missing values, just in a simple case like this, and we've got, let's just make it sort of 3 numbers per. Let's try that. Okay. It's very tempting here to put 10 and 11 here, isn't it? It's exceedingly tempting, right? Go ahead. 4, 5, 6 here, 4, 5, 6 here, 9, 10, 11 here. Why? Well, maybe there should be an interaction here. Maybe there should be 27 and 93. I don't know. It's tempting to go to say, oh, yeah, it's going to be 9, 10, 11, but you're not sure. You're not sure. So you got to be careful with that. But you would look at previous research and say, is that cell really big? And maybe then you do something about that. You put in numbers that would make it fit with previous research. And you would never have a case with just one and then... I mean, look, if you just need 3 subjects, go get 2 more subjects, damn it. I mean, it's not that bad, right? But if it was 20 subjects, 20 subjects, 20 subjects, and 5, and you had your thesis talks tomorrow... What are you going to do? Right? So remember, no matter what, though, you've lost degrees of freedom. You don't just get to add numbers and then get the degrees of freedom that you would get if those numbers were really collected. A friend of mine was reviewing an article once, and they said there wasn't... a trend. It looked significant. A correlation, in this case, wasn't. So what they did is they just doubled the number of observations. And they said, look, now it works. My friend immediately said, you can't do this. You just made up data. You can't just make up numbers, even if they're the same numbers over and over again. You don't get those degrees of freedom. People didn't know, though. It wasn't like they were cheating. They just didn't know any better. These are people that should have taken more statistics classes and also had some common sense. Just make stuff up. My hypothesis is that Stephanie's taller than me. Well, it doesn't seem to work that way, so let's just add 3 feet to her height. Now she's much taller than me and many players in the NBA. No, you can't do that. But you could make an estimate if there's a sensible reason to, okay? And people do this. Now, there are other ways to deal with this. Most of our analyses, the ones I've shown you, which with these, you know, sums of squares, the sum of the, you know, x minus x bar divided by whatever. That's called a type 1 sum of squares. Type 1 sum of squares work if the n's are equal. They work fine. They don't work very well at all when the n's are not equal. And like I said, you're actually shown to do that with a one-way analysis of variance, and it's actually wrong. But it's fixable. Software takes care of this nicely. Even something as simple as Excel doing one-way analysis of variance takes care of that. But what, type 1 sums of squares, they're the best thing to learn about because, in fact, they're the most intuitive. They're the most intuitive kinds of sums of squares.
So, like, how do you describe them?
Well, like, you know, type 1 sum of squares is like the ones we've been talking about all along, you know? Like, so here's a this. Yeah, that's a type 1 sum of squares total. It's that. The rest of these use matrix algebra, and I'm not going to show you what they look like. Because I don't want to frighten you, and I can't remember. I've tried to block out everything about matrix algebra from when I was in graduate school. They don't work very well when you got unequal ends. I don't know what that was for. Type 2 sums of squares, they're good when there's missing values. They actually take care of it, which is really nice. Note, however, there's the word but. Dot, dot, dot. If there's an interaction, they screw up. It's a different kind of way of calculating a sum of square. Yeah. It involves matrix algebra. They work fine when there's no interaction. But if there is an interaction, they tend to make bad estimates of variance. Now, the problem is, if you don't know there's an interaction, like we talked about here, do you know to use type 2s or not? Well, if you're sure there's no interaction, that's fine. But if you're not sure, you really can't use them. They have their use. They're useful in multiple regression more than anything. Type 3 sums of squares are best when you don't know if there's an interaction or not. And in fact, if you use type 3s all the time, you're safe. And while I've been showing you mathematically always type 1 sums of squares, when you do them with SPSS, they all use type 3s. SPSS uses type 3 sums of squares. Every stats package uses type 3 sums of squares. Okay? So we've learned the background when I say partitioning degrees of freedom and sums of squares. When I show you that, I'm showing you the formulas for type 1s. The type 3s are actually what the software uses, and you're saying, Dave, though, that's not nice. Yeah, but if the n's are equal, the type 1s equal the type 2s. Equal the type 3s. So you're okay. And like I keep saying, make your n's equal anyway. It makes your life a little easier for doing things like post-hoc comparisons you might have to do, things like that. Yeah, actually, if the n's are equal, type 1's equal type 2's equal type 3's. That's good. So it doesn't really matter. So the software just says, well, I'm going to default to using type 3's. If you take a look at the GLM procedure in SPSS, you actually can choose different kinds of sums of squares. Don't. Leave it alone. When you're not sure what something does, don't try, oh, I think I'll try this. It's like, you know, driving your car, you think, well, I need gas. Wonder what this diesel does to my car. You don't do that. You just keep putting gas in. Somebody here's done that. I can tell by somebody laughing. Somebody here's actually done that, haven't you? Somebody done that? You have, haven't you? Yeah. Did you wreck your engine? You wrecked your engine.
My mom's
truck. So you did it to your mom's truck, or yeah. She did it?
No, I did it.
Yeah. Does she know this?
I thought it was cheaper, so I thought.
Wow. You can have about, I think, between 10 and 20% diesel, and you could probably not completely wreck your engine, if I understand things correctly.
Yeah.
Did you tell her that you did it?
Yeah.
Okay. I was going to say, I can edit this out. You know, it's not a problem. Wow. That's great. If orange juice was cheaper, would you put that in? Actually, orange juice is much more expensive than gasoline. Gasoline is actually one of the cheapest liquids you can buy. You know that? You know the most expensive liquid in the world is printer ink. No, seriously, do the math. It's way more expensive than gold or saffron. I love saffron. Saffron, it's a spice for those of you going, what's saffron? It's used in a lot of Spanish cooking. So the nice thing here is that the type 3s are good because they do the same thing as the type 1s if your n's are equal. You should try to keep your n's equal because it makes other things easier. Of course, there's a fourth type, the type 4 sums of squares. These are designed to work on empty cells, not cases with unequal ends, actually empty cells. You got no data. You got no data at all. The problem with empty cells, I don't even know why these things were invented. Because there's no unique solution. Again, they're using matrix algebra, and if you know a little bit of matrix algebra, it involves inverting matrices and such, these sums of squares, and then you get a solution set, but it's actually not a unique solution. In fact, there is no unique solution. There's an infinite number of possible answers. Yeah, that's good. So they come up with something, but if you did, this is the amazing thing about type 4 sums of squares, if you tell them, when you do the calculations, if you say, now first do the A, now do the B, if next time you say, first do the B, now do the A, it comes up with a different solution. First do this one, then do this data point, oh, solution changes. Because the solution I'm talking about is telling you what the sum, what the A and B and A by B. It's just a very simple example like that. Because like, okay, here's an empty cell. What goes there? What number should go there? What should the mean be? These are cell means, okay? What do you think?
I just did like something really complicated.
What did you do?
Well, I added them up.
Yeah.
And then I divided them by 4, which is 2.
Yeah.
And then I added 2 to the mean.
Okay.
And then I divided that by 4, so is it 2.5?
Sure, why not? What else? Other ideas?
Yeah.
How about 8? Sure. Mike, what did you say?
Yeah.
Could be anything. What about 7,000? Why not? We don't know! We have no freaking data! Now look, even if you have, now if you had a 7 by 7 and you're missing all the data at 4 and 2, that kind of thing, like you could probably make a decent guess, and that's where you'd use type 4 sums of squares. You could make a decent guess. Or you could just go collect more data. But this is the simplest example that shows you, there is no solution to this. You don't know the answer. You literally just don't know. Right? I don't know what the hell would go there. Danielle came up with a nice methodical method, which sounded sensible enough. I could have also said, what's wrong with 4? Oh, it looks like it could be an interaction. 4, 4, 2, 2. You wanted to keep the grand mean the same? That sounds a very sensible approach you're taking. Nothing wrong with what you're saying. Nothing wrong with what anybody said, because we don't know. As my stats prof Ian used to say, the best way to analyze data with empty cells is not to collect data with empty cells. Try to get more data. If you're missing something. Or you know what? In that case, instead of doing a 2x2, turn it into a one-way analysis of variance with 3 groups. Then you can do it. Don't have some mythical empty cell that you don't know what it is. Because you don't know what to put there. There's no reason to put anything there. Especially in a case with just a 2x2. Just collect more data. You want to keep the cell means, or sorry, the cell counts, the number of observations. Try to keep them equal. Try to keep them equal. Sometimes they won't be, and that's life, but get them close to being equal. Because the software is going to use type 3s, and it's going to take care of it. All right? Questions about that? How many classes do we have left? How many? Is it 5?
Yeah, we just did...
Well, what's the date? It's the date today.
Well, it's 16th,
so we got what?
No, 1, 2, 3, 4, April 1st.
You've got 5 classes left.
Correlation and regression.
Yeah.
We're done with something.
Do you want to start correlation?
Correlation is pretty basic, then you get multiple regression.
A lot of people didn't print off the notes they're saying. Do you want me to start it or not? Okay, we got a bunch of no's and one, and t-test says yes, so we're going with no. That's your name forever, right? And so take a look at the correlation stuff for next time. We'll have a quiz on, you know, things coming up on next Tuesday. Next Tuesday, so there might be a Latin square in that one. Might be a little correlation on Tuesday. All right? See you guys next time.
Pathological monsters, cried the terrified mathematician. Every one of them was a splinter in my eye. I hate the Pino space in the Coker. I fear the Cantor ternary set. The Sierpinski gasket makes me wanna cry. And a million miles away, a butterfly flapped its wings on a cold November day. A man named Benoit Mandelbrot was born. His disdain for pure mathematics and his unique geometrical insights left him well equipped to face those demons down. He saw that infinite complexity could be described by simple rules. Used his giant brain and he turned the game around. And he looked below the storm, saw a vision in his head, a bulbous pointed form. Picked his pencil up and he wrote his secret down. Just take a point called T in the complex plane. Let's see one BZ squared plus C. Z2 is Z1 squared plus C. Z3 is Z2 squared plus C. And so on. If the series of C's will always stay close to Z and never trend away, that point is in the Mandelbrot set. Mandelbrot set. Shock test on fire, a Deagle pterodactyl. You're a heart-shaped box of springs and wire, one badass fucking fractal. And you're just in time to save the day, sweeping all our fears away. You can change the world in a tiny way. Mandelbrot's in heaven. At least he will be when he's dead. Right now he's still alive and teaching math at Yale. Gave us order out of chaos. Gave us hope where there was none. His geometry succeeds where others fail. If you ever lose your way, butterfly will flap its wings from a million miles away. And so on. If the series of C's will always stay close to Z and never trend away, that point is in the Mandelbrot set. Mandelbrot set. You're a Rorschach test on fire, a Deagle pterodactyl. You're a heart-shaped box of springs and wire, you're one badass fucking fractal. And you're just in time to save the day, sweeping all our fears away. You can change the world in a tiny way. And you're just in time to save the day, sweeping all our fears away. You can change the world in a tiny way. Come on, change the world in a tiny way. Come on, change the world in a tiny way.
This podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright, share alike 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me because I'm reserving that right. Giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.